The Bruce Cook Conversation with your host, Bruce Cook. Trending now. Here's your host, Bruce Cook.
Brought to you by New Directions for Women. We know recovery.
Thank you for joining the conversation, radio listeners. I'm Bruce Cook. Happy Sunday night. Sorry that the Angels lost today, but we proceed on with life and times here on radio, and I'm honored to be with you this Sunday night. Our conversation is taking some interesting turns tonight, but I'm going to start by doing a little bit of Hollywood talk. I'd like to share some insider information, as it were. If you've been following the Hollywood news this week, as a follow-up, actually, to the news that's been brewing there, the behind-the-scenes controversy on the Ellen DeGeneres show and the accusations of a toxic work atmosphere for the staff and the workers in Hollywood, especially on the Ellen show. This week, major moguls have fallen. The co-vice chair of NBC Universal, Mr. Ron Meyer, stepped down after a very, very long career at the top of his game in Hollywood. The reason? Alleged sexual infidelity, but worse. That's why you got to put on that worse voice. Allegations of conspiracy and blackmail and threats. And this is when it gets really interesting. Apparently, the woman at the center of this, who has also brought down other Hollywood moguls of late, was apparently involved with other producers who were perhaps using leverage with this hidden affair to demand, shall we say, open doors, green lighting, favors for their projects at Universal NBC. Apparently, this never happened, but it has become a major big deal. Anyway, I'm sharing all this because I really want to plug my book, which is called Fame Farm. And if you have any interest in Hollywood and you have any interest in the sex, the drugs, the behind-the-scenes maneuvering, you got to buy Fame Farm. $12, Amazon.com. It is a novel. It is totally fictional, but it couldn't be coming out at a better time. Let me just put it that way. And I have one more thing to say, ladies and gentlemen. If you are one of the first 20,000 people to buy Fame Farm, guess what? It'll go on to the New York Times bestseller list. So how about that? Anyway, enough plugging. But seriously, if you want a good read this summer in times of pandemic, please buy Fame Farm. It would do me a lot of pleasure. Okay, getting serious now. Our show tonight is going to take some interesting turns. My second guest, which will come on at the half-hour break, is a guest who has been on the show before. He is a really terrific guy who is a former soccer star, college player, who went on to become an attorney and then went into sports and became an athletic director. His name is Sean Farrell, and he is going to talk about what's happening in college sports in our second half of the hour. Stay tuned for that. A lot of news breaking. But up first, we're going to Alaska. And this is really going to be an interesting half hour because Charles D. Hayes is going to come on the line. He is an ex-Dallas police officer who I assume is now retired in Alaska, and we'll find out in a minute. But we got a lot to find out from this ex-cop in Dallas. He's written a book, and it's called Blue Bias, and I'll let him talk about that in our time together. But we want to know about racism. We want to know about police brutality. We want to know about defunding the police. We want to know about rioting. We want to know about the mentality and the psychology of the police department, because everybody is really concerned about this. I don't care what side of the liberal or conservative coin you're on. We need our police, and we need society to be law and order oriented, but we also need to answer a lot of really serious questions. So, Charles, are you on the phone from Alaska?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to Angels Radio. Welcome to the Bruce Cook Conversation. It's really good to have you on.
Thank you.
Can I start with a really tough question?
Sure.
How bad or how real is the idea of racism infiltrating our police departments in urban American cities. Is that a real, tangible, put your neck, your arms around it problem?
Well, implicit bias exists in the bedrock of American culture. I mean, we had 2.5 centuries of slavery, 90 years of Jim Crow, 60 years of separate but equal, 2 generations of redlining, and a double standard in treatment by policing from the very beginning, but starting about 130 some years ago. You know, but you don't have to have a racial hatred in your heart to be biased. All you have to do is see somebody as being different, and brains bias. That's what brains do. They categorize. We do that automatically. You don't have to see somebody as you don't have to hate somebody in order to treat them a little bit different than you would your the group that you consider your own.
Okay, well, that's a really good point, and I happen to agree with that 100%. But the follow-up question is, yeah, that's human nature. How is that going to be? How are we going to change that? Can we change that? Should we change it? Or do you have something else in mind?
Well, there's no, I know of no surefire way to get rid of implicit bias, except to cause people to care enough about it to when you are called on to make a judgment that where bias is usually present, to have sort of have a flashing yellow light go off in your mind and seriously think that this is the place where you need to do some extra thinking.
Well, let me ask you this. You were a Marine, I understand. What put you into the police force? What was your path? Well, how did you get into it? And what's your background? Share with us who you are.
Well, I was only on the department for a little over 4 years. And I experienced what you call burnout. About 10 years after I experienced that burnout, I became fascinated with the whole subject, and I began to study the behavioral sciences, and I've been doing that for more than 30 years and writing books about the value of self-education.
All right, well, wait a minute. How did you burn out in 4 years? There are policemen that, you know, spend a career dealing with what you're talking about.
Yeah, I didn't have the education and the perspective at the time to see human beings at their worst on a regular basis, and I began to get really disgusted by domestic disturbance calls. There were shifts when we would just go from one to the next all night long or all day long, and I began to it began to just eat on me that it seemed so infantile and so totally unnecessary for people to behave that way, and I couldn't process it. I just became overly disgusted.
You know what? This is such a great thing that you're bringing up, because I don't hear anybody in the media talking about what we're talking about tonight, that these men and women that work in that field deal with what you're talking about day in and day out, and how many of them are mentally prepared, forget about the implicit bias which exists, but how many are mentally prepared to deal with what you just said, the garbage in society that you have to put up with day in and day out?
Well, that's a really good question, but when you're doing this, your biology works against you. I mean, if you get your limbic system up to the point of fight and flight on a regular basis, the amygdala, the emotional center in your brain, will grow larger. You'll become hypersensitive, and you can just go off ballistically when somebody at the slightest provocation. I mean, there's lots of YouTube videos that make this point, and an officer just going crazy over just the slightest
provocation.
Yeah.
Right. Well, but it makes sense, because when you're putting up with this day in and day out, it's so easy to lose your temper if somebody treats you in a horrible way. So, Charles, yeah. 4 years as a police officer and you had to get out. What made you realize that you couldn't take it anymore, that you possibly could be that policeman that puts a knee on someone's neck or goes too far in that moment of horror?
I think the moment that got me was when I answered a call on Thanksgiving and met a woman with a gun in her hand who just killed her husband over the argument about the temperature to cook a turkey.
Isn't that perfect? I mean, really?
No.
I mean, it sounds like a weird movie, but it's not.
No. No.
It's not only not, but it happens too much. Yeah. You know, I have this horrible, you know, unsubstantiated theory that in days past, when our population was not so large and not so diverse, and don't call me names for saying not so diverse, but seriously, when it was a more homogenous population, the police force didn't have to deal with the kinds of things they have to deal with today. Would that be fair or accurate to say?
Oh, I think so. I think so. Now, police officers, I mean, I'm not anti-cop at all, but I believe in holding police officers to a very high standard. And and when you try to do that, it often becomes political. And we need to keep politics out of policing, because policing is about public service. The quality of life in this country, to me, depends on the balance between liberal ideology and conservative ideology. And if you go too far in either direction, you're going to wind up in a disaster.
Well, guess where we are? We've gone too far in either direction, and we are in a disaster.
Yeah.
And in terms of policing, people are lining up on both sides of the fence. You know, what do you say, Charles, in the recent times, the protesting that has occurred that has morphed into rioting, looting, and damage has really divided that line even further? And there are people that are furious, and there are others that are saying they're blowing off steam, but none of it is making sense. Something has to be done. What would you say?
Well, I believe that Black Lives Matter is a sincere effort to call attention to a double standard in policing. And like I say, I don't believe that the double standard is because police officers hate black people. I don't believe that at all. I believe it's just a matter that we need to take a hard look at the way we operate on the street, and officers need to learn how to maintain self-control. When you see officers hitting people who are not resisting, I mean, hitting them repeatedly, and that happens all the time, the officer has lost control of himself, and he's running on adrenaline.
But how much is this due to drug and alcohol abuse? Another thing that is not really discussed much in the media, that so many victims of this kind of violence are because their behavior is out of control, and the police are out of control, and they don't know what to do other than force.
Yeah, well, I wrote Blue Bias for the specific reason to prevent burnout, to reduce the unnecessary uses of force, and to increase the mutual respect among officers and citizens. And that's a very tenuous and fragile situation.
Charles, you may have lost my question because we had a bloop on the audio, but I asked about the influence of substance abuse, drugs, and alcohol. So many of these horrific incidents that have been viewed by America and the world, where there is police brutality, also have an element of drug or alcohol abuse involved, and it doesn't seem to be discussed. What do you say to that?
Well, I think you're right. I don't deny that. I'm not exactly sure how we deal with it.
How do you expect a cop? You would know better. How would you expect a cop to control his or herself from reacting in a overzealous manner when they're dealing particularly with a man, not so much a woman, but with a strong man who is hyped up on drugs or alcohol and is non-compliant?
Well, I think you can train yourself to meet whatever force is necessary, but not to continue beating on somebody who's no longer resisting, or if they say they can't breathe, to believe them.
Good point. Then how do we also, you know, the whole George Floyd situation, a big part of it was there were a squad of officers, and those not participating were standing by, and for whatever reason, loyalty, camaraderie, obedience, did not do what you just said. How does that change?
Well, that's a management problem. Management has to make that message clear. that kind of behavior won't be tolerated. I mean, if police management is not obsessed with keeping control of the use of excessive force, it will happen. I mean, it's just like I say, biology working against the officers. They need to know when to chill out and need they may need help from psychologists.
Well, I think you're right. On that note, we're going to take our break, Charles. Ladies and gentlemen, listening tonight, I'm Bruce Cook, and this is The Conversation, and I have Charles D. Hayes on the line, and we're talking about the police department. Ex-cop has a lot to say. Stay with me.
Angels Radio,
AM 830.
I'm Dr. Sandra Morgan from the Global Center for Women and Justice at Vanguard University. Thousands of men, women, and children are trafficked right here in the U.S. We are leading the charge to end human trafficking by educating first responders, parents, and students. There is so much more we can do. Help us make a difference. Go to gcwj.org/give. That's gcwj.org. Click on give. Thank you.
The census is happening now. Your participation will help your family and the Orange County community. It only takes a few minutes. Answering the 9 easy questions supports better schools, food assistance programs, emergency services, and more. Your answers are kept confidential by law, and there is no citizenship question. Everyone counts. Take the census online at my2020census.gov or by phone at 844-330-2020 by September 30th.
Have you ever wanted to learn a new language like French, Spanish, or Russian, but thought it would be too difficult and time-consuming? Then go to Babbel.com and try it for free. Babbel works because it's built around real life. It teaches you everyday practical conversations that you will actually use. In 15 minutes a day, you'll be on your way to speaking a new language in just a few weeks. Babbel uses a modern conversation-based technique that makes language engaging, fun, and memorable. It starts by teaching you words and phrases. Then, sentences gradually get more complex. Soon, you're practicing short conversations about real-life topics. Babbel is created by language experts who use the spaced repetition method to help you learn quickly and remember what you learned. With Babbel, you can speak a new language. Babbel. Language for life. Now try Babbel for free. Just go to Babbel.com and start learning a new language today. That's Babbel.com. Babbel.com.
Asking for help in life takes bravery. Women addicted to alcohol and drugs know this too well. Most suffer silently while their lives fall apart, their children and families in crisis. For more than 40 years in Southern California, New Directions for Women have helped addicted women recover at our nationally recognized addiction treatment center in Costa Mesa. Our door is wide open. Take the first step. Call us at 888-786-0509 or visit us at www.newdirectionsforwomen.org. Again, 888-786-0509. New Directions for Women. We know recovery.
Bruce Cook wants to hear from you. Now back to your host, Bruce Cook.
And we're back live, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Bruce Cook, and this is The Conversation. Tonight, we have Charles D. Hayes on the phone from Alaska. Charles, what are you doing in Alaska?
I'm retired.
And you picked a pretty good place to get away from it all.
Yeah, pretty much. I'm 77 years old.
Well, you don't sound it. You sound young. Anyway.
Well, the subtitle of Blue Bias is An Ex-Cop Turned Philosopher Examines the Learning and Resolve Necessary to End Hidden Prejudices in Policing, and I hope that's what I've done.
Well, it sounds like you're certainly trying to do that. Let me make a couple points based on what we've talked about.
Okay.
The first one is all of this violence and anxiety that's existing now, a lot of people are just dividing between black and white, and I don't believe that's the case. For example, most police forces, urban and non-urban in America, are now very diverse. They are made up of black men and women, Hispanic or Latino men and women, Asian men and women, white men and women. It's not a white police force that's beating on minorities. That is not the case, and I think you've established that, even though we've talked a bit about the bias situation. Would you agree, and as a police officer, when you were in the force, did you feel that there was that camaraderie that was based on doing a job but not on racial tension?
Well, it was pretty rough in the 60s. We had more explicit racism, actually, than implicit racism, to tell the truth.
Well, that's absolutely true because, you know, I'm talking about now, and it was a very different time.
Right.
Well, then forget that question because you can't answer it. You can't answer it the way I'd like to have it answered today. But today, don't you think, you know, talk about today. I mean, look at the lines of police in the current demonstrations. They're every color of the rainbow of those men and women standing there defending their cities, their communities. They're not just white. They're not just black. So let me put it to you this way. How do you think a black or a Latino cop feels standing in that line when blacks and Latinos are screaming and yelling at them and they're the brother?
I think they feel just like everybody else. I really do. I think black officers can also have the same hidden implicit prejudice.
And they can lose it, too. And they can lose it, too.
About 12% of the police forces right now are women. I think it ought to be 40 or 50%. I think it would help tremendously.
Boy, that's an interesting statement. And why do you think that?
Well, women are sort of better chemically cocktailed to handle conflict without losing it, without becoming disgusted, and without going off on somebody and using excessive force. They're just very good at it. I mean, the record up to date shows that.
But what would you say to someone who said, "Well, that's a great idea on record, but are they strong enough? Are they strong enough? Are they capable enough? Are they?"
Well, that's a really, really good point.
And that's probably a sexist question, but
it's going to come up. Yes. Male police officers meet people every day that are stronger, and they're often overpowered. But when they are, we don't say they weren't strong enough to do the job. That only happens when it happens to a woman.
Okay, well put. I guess you could say that about women in the military also. All right, what about defunding, Charles? What about the cries for defunding police in urban areas? Is that a good idea? Is that a terrible idea?
Well, I think it's a bad idea across the board. I mean, but having said that, I believe that there are maybe some ways to put more money into mental health and that sort of thing, but as a political issue, it's really bad too.
We didn't really get into my question earlier about when the protesting became rioting. Where do you stand on that? Where should police be in major cities like Seattle, Portland, Los Angeles, Atlanta, others? They were asked to stand down and not get involved in that. And this is a really political issue, but it's going to affect the election on November 3rd. Where do you stand? Should police get involved in that, or should they stand down? And does the mayor of a city have the right to do that?
I think the police should handle it very carefully and to try to use as much calm as possible. But I draw the line at looting and damaging property. I don't think they should put up with that. But I believe peaceful protest should be allowed to go on.
Well, I think we all agree with that, but it did cross the line. And, you know, elected officials of cities, mayors and assembly people and city councils are hired, voted, and paid for by taxpayers that expect their property to be protected and expect law and order to be maintained, and the police are taken oath to that effect. So how do you think citizens watching this kind of thing across the country feel when they see it going on and on? It is a real problem.
I think that they see it as a problem, and it is a problem. I don't really have a really, really good answer for it, and I don't think anybody else does either.
Well, but as a philosopher that you have become, as someone who has studied this, if you were still involved in policing, what would you do? What would you say? How would you handle it?
I would try to talk to the group of people who are protesting. I would try to assure them, as long as their protest was peaceful, they would be treated as if it's peaceful. And if the criminal element moved into it and began to destruct property, that we would take whatever action is necessary to stop it.
Okay. Then why was there such backlash when Trump sent in troops, National Guard, to Seattle and to Portland to break up what was going on in those two cities?
Because those troops were not asked for by the local authorities. And they came in without ID, without badges, names, and all that kind of stuff. And that's not the way we operate in this country.
Okay, but doesn't that contradict what you just said before? Even though they came in supposedly or allegedly without approval by the local authorities, the local authorities were doing nothing to stop them themselves, so the federal decided to step in.
I don't think that's true, Bruce. I don't think that's true. I think there's a whole lot of situations different and a whole lot of different reporting and don't exactly know what happened, but those people weren't needed and shouldn't have come.
I'm not sure I agree with you, Charles. I think when large city blocks are taken over by mobs and taxpayers and citizens are forced to suffer the consequences and government does nothing, something more has to be done than looking for some kind of, you know, conciliation.
There were examples of peaceful protest that became violent when those guys showed up.
Well, no, it wasn't. Though Seattle was taken over by those people, not because of it became violent because other forces came in. They came in afterwards. But,
well, to me, it was a political move to move those people in there in the first place.
Well, that's a whole other show, and we're not going there tonight. But let's finish up by plugging your book. Talk more about the book. How can we get it? Where can we get it?
Okay, Blue Bias is on Amazon, and like I say, the subtitle is "An Ex-Cop Turned Philosopher Examines the Learning and Resolve Necessary to End Hidden Prejudice in Policing."
What's the best thing you share in that book, if I could ask you that really specific and tough question as we close our time together?
Some painful experience, maybe.
Can you give us an example? Another example, besides the widow, or the widow, the murderer shooting her husband at the turkey.
Well, I went to an apartment one time, and a woman had been shot through the screen door with a shotgun in the face, and she had toddlers running around the house, and she couldn't see, and she had spread blood all over the walls, and those little kids were screaming, trying to help their mother.
You know, I think that's the worst thing I've ever heard on radio, and I probably shouldn't have asked you. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank Charles Hayes for his insight tonight. I had no idea that you had spent 30 years studying this, so your book is probably a good read. Ladies and gentlemen, check out Blue Bias. I guess it's on book sites wherever you buy your books.
Yeah, on Amazon, yes.
Charles, thanks for coming in tonight from Alaska. Be safe and onward.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Bruce Cook. This is The Conversation, and we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to switch gears.
Angels Radio.
AM 830.
Hello. Gene here with Dr. Sandra Morgan, director of the Global Center for Women and Justice at Vanguard University. The center's research has empowered students and anti-human trafficking experts to achieve real progress in the fight to eliminate this crime. Sandy, tell us what you've been doing.
Gene, did you know 80% of human trafficking recruitment happens online? We've empowered over 1,200 high school student leaders to educate their peers who are at risk. and our annual Insured Justice Conference drew 425 professionals, all focused on research and strategies to end human trafficking. Also, we provided 4 scholarships to survivors rebuilding their lives.
We have so many opportunities to make an even greater impact. With strong community support, it will happen. Please join us by going online to give. Go to gcwj.org/give.
Indeed knows you've got big goals for your business, and we understand hiring is a crucial part of that. You need to hire people who will make a real impact. Indeed can help you find those important hires faster while paying only for what you need without any long-term contracts, thanks to our super flexible payment options. Start finding your important hire today with a free $75 credit for your first job post and get in front of more quality candidates. Go to Indeed.com/high impact. That's Indeed.com/high impact. Terms and conditions apply.
Have you been to a Burlington lately? They have unbelievable deals on amazing brands and styles at up to 60% off other retailers' prices. No coupons or sales, just fabulous values every single day. It's a treasure hunt with new bargains arriving all the time and savings that'll surprise you. At Burlington, you get more for less, whether it's back to school, work, or just back. Now more than ever, you'll love the deals. You'll love Burlington.
If the woman you love, your mom, wife, daughter, sister, partner, or friend, is on a downward spiral from substance abuse and doesn't know where to turn, New Directions for Women can help. It's a Costa Mesa-based addiction treatment facility that has the answer. Since 1977, New Directions for Women has helped more than 5,000 women change their lives, returning them to sobriety, healthy living, restoring love and hope, and providing dignity for them and for their families. Don't waste another day. The woman you love needs your help now. Call New Directions. The number is 888-786-0509. Once again, call 888-786-0509 or visit them at www.newdirectionsforwomen.org. That's New Directions for Women. They know recovery.
To talk to Bruce Cook, pick up the phone and dial 714-283-8830.
And we're back. I'm Bruce Cook, and this is The Conversation. If you're just joining me, we are leaving police brutality behind for a little while anyway, and we're going to switch gears tonight. My guest in the second half hour, Sean Farrell. He is the athletic director at Cal State University San Bernardino. He is also a great friend of the show. He comes on frequently. And just a little bit of background, Sean is also an attorney. He was a soccer star growing up in school, and he's got a lot to say about what's happening in the world of college athletics, things we all need to know for ourselves, for our kids, for our communities. Sean, welcome.
Thank you, Bruce. Pleasure to be here.
It's always good to have you here. What's happening at the Cal State system, and particularly at San Bernardino, where you're the boss?
Correct. Yeah. The Cal State system right now.
By the way, congratulations. You just got married, and your wife is sitting here in the studio, but we wouldn't put her on mic.
Yes. Thank you for allowing Dr. Yumi Chin Farrell to be with us today. So
it's always good to have Dr. Yumi Chin Farrell in this studio. I feel much safer with her here.
Agreed. Same.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So the Cal State system right now, probably we're on hold. So the chancellor oversees the 23 campuses. And so whether you're Division I, San Diego State, Fresno State, or in the Big West, like Cal State Fullerton, Long Beach, or Cal State San Bernardino, we're all kind of waiting for the chancellor to tell us what we can do moving forward. So what we're looking to do is maintain practice and skill instruction, making sure we're using all the appropriate health precautions, but trying to find an avenue so our student athletes can stay engaged, stay in shape, but do it appropriately. And so that's what we're looking to do.
Is there a consensus that things do seem to be getting better, or are we still really worried?
Well, there's something new that came in. And so what's been discovered, and this is the interesting thing with the coronavirus, is that they're still learning. It's fascinating to watch science work in real time. And so we learn something new every day. And the most recent thing is the potential for heart-related issues for those that contract COVID-19. And so you may come across as having very minimal symptoms, but what we're discovering is that those potentially are being impacted with heart ailments. And that's really what slowed down the ability to compete this fall, is they're still trying to discover just how likely this can happen to you. And last thing you want is a student athlete developing a heart condition, right?
Wow. You know, it's so complicated. It's a day-to-day kind of a thing. But what does your crystal ball say in terms of the fall? Are we really going to, is it going to get worse? Or are we going to see, with a slowdown of the virus, things starting to normalize a bit more at your school for the kids, for the faculty, for your huge staff of people that are waiting to see what happens?
Well, we have the opportunity to kind of learn from other institutions. And what we're discovering is the 18 to 22-year-old population doesn't know how to manage this virus. And what I mean by that is they can't social distance. So yeah. Even on my way in today, we passed a sorority house, and they were all outside taking pictures together, a big group of them. And quite frankly, that's the norm, right? And so what we've discovered at University of North Carolina and Notre Dame and some other campuses is that the student population, they're really not interested in doing social distance. And because of that, you're having outbreaks, and people are having to shift back to being online and remote. And so at this point, there's not really a pathway forward until we get some advancements in the testing and being able to isolate. And until we have that, we can't really move forward.
It seems like that, as you said, 18 to 20-year-old population that wants to be alive and be with each other doesn't take it seriously.
Well,
what's it going to take? I mean, do people have to die? See, the thing is, I don't think they're experiencing that kind of extreme is the problem. Not the problem. It's not a good thing. We don't want people to die, but it's somebody else's problem. It's somebody else's disease. It's older people's disease.
Well, Bruce, you're a young man, so it wasn't too long ago that you were in that 18 to 22-year-old population, and you really are invincible, right? And that's one of the things I love about my job is they keep me young. Their energy, their thirst for life, it's absolutely a positive, but here's an avenue where that same vitality can be a harm, right? And so what you're discovering is the typical outcome for a young person is, even if they contract it, they're not really developing symptoms, or if they do, they're limited. But again, what we're discovering is there are some really serious outcomes, like heart, and we don't know the numbers right at this point.
What about... We talked about this the last time you were on the show, but what about all the kids that are at your school that are, in addition to playing sports and it got them in, for example, and they love it, but they're also trying to pursue an education in another field? How does this all balance out? What are you doing? How is this going to work?
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, because as we mentioned last time, we have several student athletes that the best place for them to be, even with all things being considered, is on campus. And so our residence halls are open, and we do have student athletes in them. And that's because, whether it be there's several people in their home, or they don't really have a home that they consider a safe space for them, so we have them on campus. And also, you're right, like, we have a lot of students that are pursuing majors that it just requires them to be on campus, whether it be because of the health sciences and labs, etc. So really, and this is where I really give the Cal State system a lot of credit, managing through that so we find the best pathway forward to keep kids safe, but acknowledging that there's going to be a time when we just have to be on campus and we have to be together.
Has the school actually started yet? Classes?
Tomorrow. We start this coming week, yes.
Well, how did I know to have you here tonight?
Right.
Right. So tomorrow is a big day. We're going to see exactly how it works.
Correct. And that's where, again, the campuses that have started, they're a real window into what can be done. And the biggest thing is, don't have too high of expectation, and you really got to be intentional. And you really got to ensure that you're managing through it and really educating and, quite frankly, staying on top of your student population.
When it comes to celebrating and partying, we know the kids gather in huge groups. We've talked about that a little bit. Maybe they'll be more adherent and more respectful just going to class and trying to stay apart. I'm sure the school has set up distancing everywhere, and is very prepared for this, and maybe the student body will come up and show their their stripes with this.
Well, what we have found is within the student-athlete population, there is the sincerity because they saw what happened in the spring. And some of them, like our basketball team, you know, we had to inform them that their season was over, literally practicing at the NCAA tournament. And so for like our men's basketball or our volleyball, you know, national championship team that can't defend their title this year, they understand because they've had something taken away from them. So when it comes to our student-athlete population, they get it. And so for them, it's been wonderful to see them saying, hey, look, we're going to be leaders within the student population, whether it be the social distancing, the insisting on the masks. And that's something we're pretty proud of, is to see them be leaders on campus.
Do you think a lot of these kids that are playing sports and take it seriously will want to do a fifth or a sixth year so that they can fulfill that career? Because I'm sure some of them still have aspirations to go on.
Well, and that's what's fascinating, is so what you have now is potentially some student athletes with 6 years of eligibility and not being able to participate for 2 years. And so what you have within the sport is a decision for the coaches. Is it best in this student's best interest to move on? Or is it in the student's best interest to maintain their eligibility and to come back and compete? And so sometimes there's a real hard conversation that has to take place that say, you know, we value you, we appreciate you, but really the opportunities for here, you need to graduate and take that next step in life. And then, like, we have, you know, the returning National Player of the Year in volleyball, and darn right, we want her to come back and, hey, maybe you need to get a master's, right? And so, and that's the beauty of some of these students that really do their work in the classroom, is they're going to get a master's degree because take advantage of the fact that they're here for 6 years.
What about your coaches? How's the morale?
And this is where I'm really impressed, and with the work, because they're educators, right? And they're also someone that's steeped in using competition as their education tool. And so, like anybody else, there's been ups and downs, but primarily I've been so thoroughly impressed with our coaching staff and how they've understood what's going on. I don't want to say accept, because coaches just never accept that there's not a pathway forward. But what I will say is they're constantly challenging, trying to find an appropriate way to maintain support of their student athletes and also find a pathway forward to continue to play.
On that, Mr. Farrow, we got to take a break. And we will be back, ladies and gentlemen, listening tonight to Angels Radio. I'm Bruce Cook, and this is The Conversation with Sean Farrell. We're talking college athletics and life.
Angels Radio.
AM 830.
Hello, G. Morgan here, reminding you that human trafficking for sex and forced labor is happening here in Orange County. You also need to know that the Global Center for Women and Justice at Vanguard University is recognized as a leader in the fight to end modern day slavery. Won't you join me in supporting the Global Center? Together, we can make a difference. To give, go to gcwj.org/give.
Every day, friends, family, and neighbors struggle with emotional pain. For some, this can include thoughts of suicide. Though the warning signs can be subtle, they are there. Go to suicideispreventable.org and learn how to recognize the signs, start a conversation, and connect someone to help. You have the power to make a difference, the power to save a life. Learn more at suicideispreventable.org. Supported by the Orange County Healthcare Agency through the Mental Health Services Act.
City of Hope Orange County is a safe place to receive world-class cancer care. That's why we're continuing our life-saving treatments at City of Hope Newport Beach. I'm Dr. Wade Smith, a medical oncologist specializing in breast cancer. With the breast cancer rate in Orange County 25% higher than the national average, our communities need our highly specialized care. Please stay safe so as to not let COVID-19 delay screening and treatment. If you or your loved ones need cancer care, City of Hope Orange County is here for you. Make an appointment today by calling 949-763-2204 or visit cityofhope.org/newport. Beach.
Rip open and discover the excitement with Topps baseball cards. Collecting is fun for both kids and adults. Collect your favorites. Packs feature everything from top stars, rookies, game-used memorabilia, autographs from baseball players across the league, as well as special inserts and surprises. Find packs at local hobby shops, Target and Walmart stores, and on Tops.com. Visit Tops.com for more information on products and promotions, and follow along on social media with @Tops to start your collection today.
If the woman you love, your mother, wife, daughter, sister, partner, or friend, is on a downward spiral from substance abuse and doesn't know where to turn, let us help. New Directions for Women, a Costa Mesa-based addiction treatment facility, has the answer. Since 1977, we have helped over 5,000 women change their lives, returning them to sober, healthy living, restoring love, hope, and dignity to them and their families. Don't wait another day. The woman you love needs your help now. Call us at 888-786-0509 or visit us at www.newdirectionsforwomen.org. Again, 888-786-0509. New Directions for Women. We know recovery.
Bruce Cook wants to hear from you. Now back to your host, Bruce Cook.
And we're back. I'm Bruce Cook, and this is The Conversation. And I might also mention, ladies and gentlemen, listening to Angels Radio tonight, if you've missed part of the show or you want to hear something again, The Bruce Cook Conversation can be picked up on podcast. We're on a whole bunch of different podcast networks, probably your favorite one, and I encourage you to check it out. Anyway, we are here tonight with our friend Sean Farrell, and we're talking about college sports. He is the athletic director at Cal State University San Bernardino. What about students taking their classes more seriously in this pandemic? Do you think kids, because there's been so much confusion and so much downtime and weirdness, when they go into that class, they're going to be more tuned in and more serious about learning something?
Well, what I've discovered or what we've
Or am I crazy?
Well, those are two different questions now.
As long as they don't have the same answer.
Right. So we're going to leave that second one aside. But what we found is they have to be more intentional now. So if, because especially for student athletes, because their sport is on hiatus right now. So for them, the classroom is a choice at this point because they don't know when the opportunity to get back on the court, the field, et cetera, is going to occur. So what we have found is they have to make a choice that they want to be engaged in the classroom. And so for us at San Bernardino, so we had our best term ever last spring. We had an all-student-athlete GPA of over a 3.45, which is pretty incredible.
Compare that to other colleges.
Well, typically in the Cal State system, you're happy if your student athletes are above a 3.0. So we're doing exceedingly well. And so and this is where I'm back to our coaches conversation. We had 100% return for fall, even knowing that they're not going to be able to play in their sport. So our student athletes are coming back. And right now, the only thing they're coming back to that they can be certain about is the classroom. And so what we're seeing is kids are saying, well, I'm going to take advantage of this opportunity because what else can I be doing right now? Maybe a little bit of work. But the reality is they could move forward to get their degree. And so it's been pretty impressive to see them be resolute and really stay focused in that setting.
The student athletes that are on scholarship, are they still getting whatever benefits that they need to get even though they're not playing?
Correct. Yeah, we've really ensured that we're going to maintain that promise that we made to them. And I give the president of our university a lot of credit in that we are absolutely, and that's one of the things we're focused on in fundraising is, okay, how do we reach out to our community to say, let's find ways to continue to support our student athlete population because the needs are growing, right? Everybody's struggling a bit. And so can we find ways to continue to support our student athlete?
Supporting student athletes and supporting colleges through sports is a huge big question mark. It is a big part of the whole higher education system. We know that. We hear about these various stories and cases with the big schools and what they're dealing with, which I'm going to ask you about in a second. Mm-hmm. But getting to the subject of fundraising, I have noticed, interestingly, with this COVID and in Orange County in particular, there are so many nonprofits that are really in trouble because they can't hold events. They can't bring in large crowds. And they've turned to social media and they've turned to Zoom meetings, and they've turned to whatever they can do to raise money to support their causes. Can a school do that? And should a school do that? And is Cal State doing that? Because your donors hopefully still have a connection to the school and still want to make it supportive, or still want to support it and support those kids.
Yeah, so for us, I can speak to it's two ways. So you're right. First of all, you nailed, since we're not having sporting events and we can't bring people to our home, we'll put it that way. And so what we've done is social media, absolutely, and taking advantage of technology. But another thing we're doing is making a real commitment to reach out individually. And actually, me and my fundraising team, Ryan Cook, we've really made a commitment this year to really focusing on the individual relationship, because quite frankly, I have the time to really make those individual connections that made it very challenging when all the world of your job is going on, right? So for me specifically, I've really made a very intentional choice this year to really continue to nurture those individual relationships and really understand and have that conversation with just how important their gift is to our athletics department.
In the attempt at full disclosure, I need to explain the aside to Ryan Cook. Ryan Cook is my son, who actually works for my guest Sean Farrell in the athletic department at Cal State's San Bernardino. Tough question. The big schools are grappling with the idea that athletes need to be paid. Talk to me.
Well, so a couple of things there. First of all, on average in the Power Five system, they're looking at a $65 million loss this year if football doesn't occur. So it's going to change, if that does happen, it's going to change what athletics looks like. And that helps shape the conversation with regards to payment. The challenge that you have with paying directly a student is it just changes the whole dynamic of the relationship. And not to get too into the weeds here, but what it means is then you have an employee-employer relationship, and that changes everything. And so from a tax standpoint, a legal standpoint, so really what we're asking is there a way to slice the pie so the student-athlete that in the sports that generate the revenue, primarily football, but also men's basketball, and those are really the two sports that generate revenue beyond what their costs are, right? And so is there a way to be able to funnel benefits to a student-athlete? And I think that's what you're talking about with name, image, and likeness, which is...
Except what about somebody who says, heck, these athletes are on full scholarship. They can get a graduate degree if they want. Everything is paid for. Food, clothing, they have nothing to worry about. Why should they also be paid a salary? The really good ones will go on to the pros. Well, why should that happen?
Well, and that's the question about how you change the dynamic of the relationship. And so exploitation, I don't agree with that argument, that those that say the student-athlete is exploited, because there really are. You're making an intentional choice to be a part of the system, and you have avenues to go directly into professions, whether it be foreign leagues like in basketball or in football. Frankly, you don't have a lot of options, but you're starting to see that develop with the XFL and some other, and I think you're going to see an opportunity for an 18, 19-year-old go directly in professional when those get more fully robust.
And also, let me interrupt you.
Yeah.
Only a fraction of those players, even at the best schools, go on to the pros. Let's not forget that. And the rest of them are coming out with a degree from a really fine school and hopefully are smart enough to use it.
Well, what you're going to ask yourself, too, is that right now, essentially what you have, you could argue there's a salary cap, to your point about all the benefits that we're seeing, and everybody's getting the same. So the question becomes, it's really the quarterback, the wide receiver, the linebacker, the All-Americans that are generating the revenue. So is the third-string offensive lineman that never makes it on the field, are they going to get that same, you know, equal benefit, so to speak?
And no.
So, exactly.
It's called reality.
And that's the question you have.
What happens if this happened at a state school? Let's say you get a star football player, not just the volleyball girl. The volleyball girl might be asking for money. I got to tell you, you better be ready. What happens if it happens at Cal State San Bernardino? What will your chancellor do?
Well, I think, again, what we're going to do in Division II, we're seeing it as well, is that the name, image, and likeness. And so, and this is an issue, again, having the legal background, practiced law for several years before I moved into this, is I always struggled ethically on why a student athlete shouldn't be able to profit off their name. The reality is, if, and the example I used to always give, a name of the past that was a huge college player is Tim Tebow. He was at the University of Florida. And I used to say, if the Floridians want to buy the Tim Tebow Christmas album and there's 100,000 people out there that want to buy it, then so be it. He should have that opportunity. And I really, and that's the reality, is a student athlete, if they have a name, especially with social media.
But that's also separate and apart. He's not selling his football scholarships or his football talent. He's selling the fact that he also happens to be a musician and a Christian whatever and could sell that album.
But not historically. That's actually, you couldn't do that. I previously had a student athlete that was an amazing singer. Her dad was a music producer, and she self-produced an album, and she actually couldn't use her image or her name to market that. And so, but that's my point, is if you're a stud athlete and somebody wants to sign your, take your autograph for $10, then quite frankly, they should have that opportunity to do it. There's really no, I think, moral, ethical argument against allowing them to profit off their name.
Okay. I'll buy that. What do you say to that?
I'm surprised. That was too easy.
I'm not going to disagree. I don't have a problem with that, but I don't think they should be paid salaries at all, and I don't think there should be any equality of salary if there was a salary. It's not realistic. It doesn't exist in the real world.
It's not college athletics. If we ever reach the stage where the courts force the issue and they say a student athlete should get paid, basically what you've done is you've just destroyed the whole system, and you won't have what you have today. And that would be really unfortunate. I think there is a pathway forward to allow a student athlete to receive a certain level of benefit, but to change the dynamic of the relationship to move an employee-employer, I think would be a huge mistake.
We don't have much time left, but I'm going to ask you a political question. A lot of our candidates in the upcoming election are talking about free college, free junior college. Do you think that at some point in the state of California, it would be wise to have tuition-free state college?
Well, right now, the Cal State system is the most heavily subsidized in the country. The amount of tuition that our students pay doesn't come close to actually covering the cost of what it takes to educate a student. And so we're in a modified version of that right now. So the question that as a society we have to ask, do we want to take that next step? And I'm a firm believer in skin in the game. And it's amazing how much more seriously we take something when we're obligated to put a little skin in the game. And so to go fully take on that obligation, and I'm saying we do that right now. But what we're doing is we're also telling the student, we need you to put a little skin in the game to make sure you take it seriously.
You know what? I love that. I love ending the show like that. Sean Farrell, thank you for coming into the conversation today. All the best tomorrow when school opens. Yumi, thank you for coming with your husband tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it. The conversation is over. I'm Bruce Cook. I hope you stay safe all week. Wear your mask and listen to me next Sunday night on Angel Radio or on your favorite podcast. Good night, everyone.